Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, where couples choose the gifts they want and find the things they need. Club Wed can get you started with their online pre-registry, online at Target.com. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today it's eating on the cheap in one of the world's great food towns. We're going to Honolulu to learn what real Hawaiian food is about. Our guide is Hawaiian food authority and restaurant critic John Heckethorne. Spam sushi, anybody? Gene McManus, food editor of the Washington Post, introduces us to the hands-down winner of their canned chicken broth tasting, a broth you can build a soup on. We have a lesson in self-sufficiency and sustainability from an unexpected source, the island of Cuba. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan explains what makes the ideal wine glass. Cheesemaker Jonathan White introduces us to a new cheese on the market from a unique source, yak cheese from Tibet. And as we do every week in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. That number's 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to roll. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Hi, Lynn.
Hello, Jane. What's up?
Well, I was thinking about Albuquerque, New Mexico, because Michael and I were just there. And I want to give you a piece of trivia. Do you remember what TV character was from Albuquerque?
I'm blank.
Ethel Mertz. That was her hometown, was Albuquerque, New Mexico, if you watched I Love Lucy. And I always, ever since, you know, being a great Ethel Mertz fan, always wanted to go to Albuquerque. It, also, just for the spelling of it. I mean, it's great to live in a town that you can't spell the name.
Hey, forget Ethel Mertz. Forget spelling. Can we go to the Frontier Restaurant on Central Avenue, which is Old Route 66, and eat some cinnamon rolls?
Oh, okay. I guess we have to get serious here. Why we went to Albuquerque. We had heard for years about this legendary restaurant open 24 hours in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Frontier. And we had seen people wearing T-shirts that showed these gigantic drawings of cinnamon rolls on the front of the T-shirts. In fact, when we got there and we saw the cinnamon rolls in real life, they were about as big as they are on the T-shirts. I would say a Frontier cinnamon roll, which you can get 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is probably a foot square, wouldn't you say, Michael?
It's huge. It's huge. But, you know, the funny thing is we went there for the cinnamon rolls, but what we discovered were some of the best breakfast burritos I have ever had, filled with green chili, cheese, hot peppers, and ground beef. I mean, this is a way to start the day.
The Frontier is a place where all the students from the University of New Mexico hang out. And you'll go in there and you'll see tables that are just devoted to study groups from the university, people who kind of basically live at the Frontier and eat three meals a day there. It's a really funky restaurant. It's filled with portraits of John Wayne, steer horns on the wall, romantic paintings of soaring eagles, paintings on velvet of bold stallions, and some not very good Pueblo pottery, but the food and the cinnamon rolls are worth the trip.
And the place itself is gigantic. It is literally a full city block long. I don't know how many people it seats, but it's got to be many hundreds.
So what else do they do?
Well, what else they do, and this is not what they do in food, but I kind of really love this, is the way you order is you stand up sort of cafeteria style with a tray, and you wait for a traffic light to lead you into the line. If it's red, you stand there with your tray. When the traffic light turns green, you rush in and you place your order. And the line is so fast at this place, you will guaranteed to get your meal within 2 minutes of placing your order.
If, for example, you order a green chili cheeseburger, which is a wonderful thing to order in this place, it will still be sizzling in its bun when you get it. It comes off the grill that fast.
So it seats probably half the population of Albuquerque.
And half the population of Albuquerque could be satisfied with one sweet roll. I mean, it really is about 10,000 calories per sweet roll and enough to feed 10 people.
And as a balance for something on the savory side, you have the breakfast burrito.
There you go.
Oh, the green chili hamburger. Good.
Yeah, okay. You can't go wrong here.
Green chili cheeseburger. Please don't forget the cheese. It's an essential part of that package.
I'm sorry. I slipped.
You're forgiven.
Thank you, Michael.
For now.
You're welcome, Lynn.
You're
Thank
no
you
Ethel
both.
Mertz. Goodbye.
Goodbye, guys.
The Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them every week here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. There's a dirty little secret in the food world. Most of us who are touted as serious cooks do not always simmer our own chicken broths. We can be found skulking out of markets with canned broth stuffed under our coats, lest our reputations be sullied. So now you know why I'm doubly delighted to hear that the Washington Post food section set out to find the best canned chicken broth by doing a blind tasting. It was the bright idea of food editor Jean McManus. Jean? Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
Okay, so how did you set up this tasting?
Well, it was a blind tasting, and one hot summer morning, believe it or not, we heated up 27 cans of chicken broth. These were cans that didn't need anything added to them, no water. We didn't use any of the compressed cubes. Uh-huh. We heated them up. We put them in clear glass bowls, and we lined them up on my desk. And I don't want to tell you exactly what that looks like, but everybody that walked by thought we were doing drug testing.
Okay, so you had 27 broths.
27 broths.
What? You had to have preconceptions here, right?
Yeah, I had the strongest preconceptions. And then I thought to myself, well, listen, we're journalists. We're supposed to challenge our preconceptions. My preconceptions were that the boxed broths would taste better because they wouldn't have a tinny flavor, mm-hmm. and that low-sodium broths would taste better because most chicken broths are too salty. So those were the assumptions I was challenging. I had read in a rival publication that a box broth, the Swanson's box broth, was superior. And so that's the one I had just been religiously buying for the last 2 years. But I couldn't tell which that broth was once we lined them up in this tasting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happened?
We started with the first one. It tasted like salty water. We went to the second one. It tasted like salty water. Thank God we came to the third one. We leaned over the bowl and we smelled it. It smelled like chicken. It was a nice, clear yellow color, a very pleasant color, something that looked like what you would use to make a chicken soup. And then we tasted it. It tasted like chicken. So there we stood at number three, and at least we had a standard. And so we looked down the line and saw the remaining 24 glasses and began to sip those and see how they measured up to the third one. And we would like one or two of them, but we would come back to number three. Still tasted better, still tasted like chicken.
Okay. So was number three the winner?
Number three was the winner. Again, we drank a lot of hot broth that summer morning. And number three was the broth that I had grown up using, that I had wandered away from. It was College Inn chicken broth, not low sodium, and in a can. So all of my assumptions had proved completely wrong.
So where did the box broth, because we hear so much about these, where did they fall?
They were acceptable, I would say. The Swanson's was nice, and even the Swanson's low sodium and fat-free was very good. It seems to me, though, that when somebody is trying to make chicken stock and they take salt away, salt is a flavor enhancer. So they add something else. They add another flavor. And what you often got and what we found with the Swansons was that you had a perfectly acceptable broth. It just didn't taste like chicken broth. Upon those broths, I would not build my soup.
But on collagen, you would.
On collagen, I would. And I have to say, you know, I'm a food editor. We run a food section. We like to encourage people to cook. We tell people it's really easy to make your own chicken broth. But do you always? No. You come home, it's late at night, you want to make a risotto, you want to throw something together on the stove. Those canned chicken broths are mighty handy. And I immediately went to the store before my own article was published, and I have to confess, I hoarded collagen chicken broth. I still have a shelf down in the basement with about 20 cans of it, and you can't have it.
So, Jean, was there a broth that was the real loser?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, come on, Jean, name names.
Well, the Pacific Organic free-range chicken broths were a big disappointment. We were very optimistic about them. We bought them at Trader Joe's, and, you know, they had the free-range, you know, emblazoned all over them, and we thought that that promised, you know, good things. It did not. The chef's broth that we really did not like at all was Dominique's. It just didn't taste anything remotely like chicken broth. And when we looked at the labels, what was in these broths, we often found that they were just loaded with sort of bizarre herbs and spices. Again, sort of trying to hide up the fact that they didn't have the flavor of chicken, that they were giving you flavor, but it wasn't what you would want in a risotto or in a chicken soup.
Okay, so we're going to go out and hoard collagen.
Lynn, I've got some in the basement. You're a friend. I'd be happy to give you some if you have trouble finding it.
You're a pal, Jean. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Jean McManus hoards her collagen in Washington, D.C., where she's food editor of The Washington Post. Now, you can get some of the results of their chicken broth tasting on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, try out that winning broth in a chicken soup recipe that works for company or for a light supper for the family. It's called Modena's Spiced Soup of Spinach and Cheese, Parmesan cheese. Now, what this really is Italian egg drop soup. This is how it works, okay? By the way, straight from the Renaissance. You beat eggs and Parmesan cheese and you thread it in to a chicken broth that you've spiced with cinnamon and nutmeg. And at the last minute, you drop in shredded spinach that turns emerald green. Great soup. Healthy, delicious, and if you have a cold, you're going to love it. Okay, you can get it at the trusty website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, an insider's guide to real Hawaiian food at bargain prices, the world's first yak cheese, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. want to take you to one of the world's great food towns, and probably one you've never thought of. Here's a couple of hints. It has a uniquely concentrated and complicated ethnic heritage because it's thousands of miles from anywhere, and it's American. I'm talking about Honolulu, to my mind, one of the most fascinating places to eat on the entire planet. So you say, okay, that's great, but who can afford it? Hawaii is legendary for high prices. Well, right now, airfares and hotel rates are way down, and we've got the man who knows where the Hawaiians eat, the great bargain spots. He's John Heckethorn, and for the past 15 years, he's been reviewing restaurants all over the islands. He joins us from the studios of Hawaii Public Radio. John, hello.
Hey, good morning, Lynn. How are you?
I am
swell. I wish you were here.
So do I, and so do probably all our listeners. But before talking about what to eat, what is Hawaiian food? How would you define that?
Well, I think you need to be careful because there's Hawaiian food, which is the food of the indigenous Hawaiian people. Of course, that's changed over the last 200 years quite a bit. But there's also Hawaii food, which is not just Hawaiian food, but layer upon layer of food, because first the Hawaiians came, then the Americans, both the whalers and then the missionaries, then the Chinese came, and the Japanese came, and the Filipinos came, and the Portuguese came. So there is a kind of food that is Hawaii food that is made up of all cultures.
So give me an example of what someone who is Hawaiian, a traditional food for them.
Okay, a lau lau would be a traditional food for a Hawaiian. It would be pork and seafood wrapped in luau leaves, which is the top of the taro plant, and then wrapped in a tea leaf and then steamed in an underground oven.
Now, a tea leaf, not as in a tea leaf we have in a tea bag, but tea leaf is these big leaves that grow outdoors there.
Yeah, big, shiny green leaf. It's a beautiful leaf. Things are served on tea leaves because they're quite large and they're quite beautiful.
So, John, what do people in the islands eat today?
They eat from a wide variety of cultures all the time. And they're dishes that are mixtures of the various cultures that have grown up. One of the funniest is called a spam musubi, which is a rice ball covered with a slice of teriyaki spam, and which is held on by a strip of seaweed. Now, this is a cross-cultural dish that, as far as I know, exists only in Hawaii, but all school children in Hawaii eat this in preference to hot dogs and hamburgers. Golfers eat it on the golf course. It's kind of a Hawaii snack food that doesn't exist anywhere else.
You know, people associate spam with Hawaii. Was this something that came because people, you know, didn't have any fresh food?
Yeah, exactly. Meat was always scarce in the islands, and we're now talking back but before World War II, say, when canned food was a real boon. And that's true not just in Hawaii, but all through the Pacific. People developed a taste for canned corned beef, for Vienna sausage, for spam. Now, I do want to say that we have all the Colorado lamb and California beef and fresh meat that you could possibly want here now. It's just that, in fact, people have a taste for canned meat, and of course it's cheap.
Yeah. Well, okay, give me an example. Where can I go to eat on the cheap?
Well, the first thing I think you should do is actually eat Hawaiian food, because Hawaiian food is inexpensive. If you're stuck in a resort, now I understand how Hawaii gets the reputation for being expensive, because if you get, especially on the neighbor islands, and you're in a resort which is self-contained and you have to actually get in your rental car and drive, that can get expensive. But what you do is you ask the guy who brings you your car where he eats, and he'll tell you. You should make the effort to seek out a real Hawaiian experience, not one at a commercial luau, but an actual place to eat Hawaiian food, like Iva's place. I remember when you were here, I took you to the bowling alley.
Yeah.
And we ate our way through the Hawaiian menu. The other thing that you want to eat when you're in Hawaii is Asian food. If you ask me, Honolulu has the best ground level Asian food in America. I mean, in all due deference to San Francisco and all due deference to New York, what I mean by ground level food is the kind of food where you just walk in off the street and buy it for about $6 for lunch, say. We have just wonderful Asian food, wonderful Chinese food, wonderful sushi of all kinds. If you're in Waikiki, eat noodles. They're just every block or so. They're noodle shops. And you don't need to know what you're ordering because very often they have plastic displays of the food outside. So you can just point if you want to do that and say, I'll try that. In fact, my favorite place has a plastic bowl of noodles about 6 feet wide mounted to the wall. And as far as I can tell, that's the only sign, because there may be a sign in Japanese somewhere, but there's no sign in English. You look for the giant noodles on the wall. The other thing you want to eat here is curry. And it's not Indian curry. No one in their right mind would fly to Hawaii to eat Indian curry. What I'm talking about is Japanese curry. Now, do you know the story of how the Japanese got curry?
No. How did they do it?
This is really funny. The curry went from India to England, where, of course, it became what we think of as curry sauce, which is actually an English kind of flour-based gravy, roux-based gravy with curry flavoring. And that golden kind of curry sauce went into the mess on the British Navy ships. And when the Japanese decided they needed a modern fleet, they looked around. The British had the best fleet, so they copied everything right down to the mess room menu.
So they were eating English food on Japanese ships?
Yeah, but of course the Japanese eat it on rice. So curry rice is now a hugely favorite casual food, both in Japan and in Hawaii. We just love curry rice.
Okay, John, so we're going to ask Hawaiians where they eat. But
right.
What would you like us to take home?
I think you should take home crack seed, because nobody in the mainland United States ever has tasted crack seed. It's hard to explain, but just quickly, it's dried fruit plus salt plus anise plus sugar. It's really a lot of focused flavors. It comes in 100 varieties. You just buy an assortment and take them home, because if nothing else, you'll get a reaction. It won't be just the same old chocolate-covered macadamia nuts. It'll be something that your neighbors and friends have absolutely never seen.
And it's a snack food and not a drug.
It's a snack food and not a drug, yes. It's crack seed from the taking of the dried plum and cracking it open rather than crack.
Okay.
We're so innocent here, crack meat's candy to us.
John, thank you.
You're welcome.
John Hickathorn is editor and restaurant reviewer of Honolulu Magazine. You can get John's picks of bargain places to eat on our website, splendidtable.org. There's another island with its share of surprises. It's 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and it might stimulate some thinking about how we eat. Here in the United States, organic foods and eating what's grown locally are basically for the privileged and rarely supported by the government. On the island of Cuba, however, organic agriculture plays a different role. Reporter Mary Stuckey made a visit.
When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, it threatened the very survival of the Cuban people. Half the food consumed in Cuba had been imported, much from the Soviet bloc. Suddenly, there was a serious food shortage and little money to buy fertilizer or fuel. By the mid-1990s, Cuban food production halved. Thousands of Cubans were malnourished.
Everyone expected bread riots on the streets, people clamoring for food, and many people expected the government would fall.
Minor Sinclair is a food policy expert who was working in Cuba for Oxfam at the time. He says the Cuban government avoided disaster through a bold move, declaring the country's farms would go organic. Oxen replaced tractors in the fields. And in the cities, wherever there was a patch of vacant land, up sprang an urban garden. A windmill pumps water for this garden. Trucks rumble down a wide boulevard in residential Havana. 10 years ago, this was a weed patch. Now it's a lush jungle of vegetables, spices, and fruit. Through a translator, gardener Ignacio Aguilares Garcia explains he feeds 10 family members from his plot.
Aquí hay 43 parceleros.
Here we have 43 farmers, producers.
Y comercializan el producto aproximadamente
8. Maybe only 8 or 10 sales the products. The rest use the products for their own consumption. Mm-hmm. You work on your piece of land, and you get your own productions, and you do with your production whatever you want to.
Nowadays, most Cubans have enough to eat. Urban gardens produce more than half of the fruits and vegetables consumed in Cuba. By law, no chemicals can be used on any urban gardens.
Utilizamos todos son los productos orgánicos.
We use organic products.
Por ejemplo, abono orgánico.
Organic fertilizer.
Eso es extracto de.
Almost our compost.
Sí. Hay niños.
Your children.
Y esos productos químicos,
this,
si lo viertes aquí, bueno, pues.
Chemical products in this area.
Por lo tanto, no se utilizan.
Affected by the actions of those all those chemical products.
This commitment to organic urban gardening has attracted attention throughout the world. For people working in alternative agriculture, Cuba is renowned. Many are visiting the island to see Cuba's methods with their own eyes. Master gardener Diane Dodge was in Cuba recently, part of a group organized by Food First, a California organization supporting alternative agriculture in Cuba.
We don't know an agrarian city, sir, and Havana is, I don't know what else to call it. It's an agrarian city.
26,000 people work urban gardens. And so the experts are asking, is Cuba's system of urban gardens worth exporting to the U.S. and other countries? Does it make sense that valuable urban land be used to grow food? Oxfam's Minor Sinclair says yes.
You produce it locally. You get people involved in the production. You market it locally. You can buy, go out and walk two blocks and buy a head of lettuce that's been removed from the earth right there in front of your eyes. That head of lettuce lasts a week in your refrigerator. Better product, cheaper prices, and better income for the farmers, too.
Of course, urban gardens didn't single-handedly avert starvation. The government also broke up inefficient state farms, placing more land in private hands. But as Cuban agriculture rebounds, some wonder about the future of urban gardens. American producers of chemical fertilizers and pest controls want to sell to Cuba, and as the economy improves, the temptation to increase yields through the use of chemicals may take over alternative methods. Roberto Caballeros, a horticulturalist with a Cuban research institute, explains in the future, Cubans will probably use a combination of organics and chemicals, but will resist business pressures.
The business of the people who sell chemical products is sell chemical products. They have nothing to do with the agriculture, and they have to convince you that if you want more yield, you must use more product. But in the reality, it's not so. What we must do is an intelligent agriculture.
That makes sense to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Wayne Munson, who was also part of the Food First group visiting Cuba.
You know, they know how to feed themselves. I'm not sure that Americans would know how to feed ourselves if there was a crisis where the food supply stopped.
Cuba managed by combining urban gardens with organic agriculture and the slow unleashing of capitalistic reforms. But unlike other developing countries, the move toward free markets in Cuba did not put small farmers off the land. In fact, farmers are making more money than many other professions, another sign that the Cuban experiment in alternative agriculture might bear fruit in other nations as well.
Mary Stuckey is an independent producer who makes her home in St. Paul. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is an expert with a down-to-earth approach. She and her husband, Ed McCarthy, author the Wine for Dummies series of books. And Mary often stops by the Splendid Table to talk wine. Mary, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Mary, I want to talk about wine glasses. Does it really make a difference what we drink wine out of?
Well, you know, if you're just drinking wine casually and you're not paying a lot of attention to it, then no, it doesn't matter. But if you're interested in wine, you're curious about what you're tasting, you're paying attention to what you're tasting, and if you're drinking fine wine, then the glass is critical to the enjoyment of the wine.
What does a wine glass do?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. It really does have a function. It's not just a container for holding an individual portion of wine. A wine glass is sort of the casing, you know, like a sausage casing. It's sort of the casing for the aromas of the wine. And the aroma molecules of a wine, as a wine sits in a glass, the glass is half full, the aroma molecules evaporate and sit there in the airspace of the glass waiting for us to smell them. And the glass carries those aromas to our nose. And the shape of the glass and the size of the glass governs the nature of the evaporation of these aromas and how they're held for us. And I think that this is so critical. If you don't have a proper wine glass, you just cannot taste all of the wine. To me, to drink wine out of a poor glass is sort of like trying to eat soup with a fork.
Huh. Well, okay, so is there a typical red wine glass then and a white wine glass?
You can use any glass for any type of wine. Generally, white wine glasses are a little bit smaller, but they don't have to be. The two basic shapes of glasses are fairly straight-sided bowls and rounder balloon-type bowls.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two. And honestly, you can use either one for white or for red. There is one producer, one glassmaker named Riedel, who has made different glasses for different types of wines, a Chardonnay glass, a Riesling glass, etc. And they're excellent, and they really do work well for the style of wine that he recommends for that glass. But I think you can also experiment. I think it's nice to have a couple of different shapes around. And often at dinner, we'll pull out one glass, serve the wine in it, I'll taste the wine and say, you know what? I just want to try this in another glass. And we'll take out a different shape of glass, and I'll try the wine, and I'll like it better in the new glass or not. And then I'll decide which one to continue drinking it from.
All right. So is there a paragon of wine glasses? What makes a good wine glass?
Well, a good wine glass has to be at least 10 ounces in capacity. 12 ounces is even better. The sides have to curve inward from the widest part of the bowl. Usually they have stems, but they don't have to have stems. You can have some, there are some short stem glasses that can go into your dishwasher. And the important thing, the more important thing than the stem, is the bowl itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the bowl can be rather elongated or it can be rounded. These are the two basic shapes.
Does it have to be expensive?
No, no. Obviously, the more expensive glasses are hand-blown. They're very fine. They have a very fine lip so that when you put the glass to your own lip, you almost don't feel that there's a barrier between you and the wine. You feel like it's just the wine on your lip, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then other glasses are clunkier. The finer, the better. But you can get good wine glasses as little as $5 a stem.
A good gift idea.
It is.
Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband Ed McCarthy of the Wine for Dummies series of books. You can get Mary's tips on wine glasses on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, time for our weekly trivia question. Now, this week, this is pure nonsense. Here's the question. What does propelling a boat with a long pole, football, and a wine bottle have in common? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We'll be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number, by the way, is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food query. A truly trivial question. It was, what do the following have in common? Propelling a boat with a long pole, the game of football, and a wine bottle. Well, it's the word punt. You punt, especially on the River Thames in England, when you propel a flat-bottomed boat with a long pole. You punt, by the way, in gambling when you bet against the bank. And in football, a punt is a drop kick. As far as the wine bottle goes, the punt is that deep indentation at the bottom of the wine bottle. It's there to strengthen the bottle. You know, there's another thing about wine bottles. Their shapes are a code, and if you know the code, you can often tell what's in the bottle without looking at the label. Talk about impressing folks. Example, Chardonnays with any pretensions, no matter where they're from, are in wider-based, bell-like bottles with long sloping shoulders. Now, that bottle's also used for red Burgundy-style wines, Rhone wines, Italian Barberas, and a ton of others. A heftier version of this shape is used for champagne and almost anything that bubbles. Now, if you stretch that bell shape into a tall, slender bottle, you have a home for German-style wines like Gewürztraminers and Rieslings. The other major shape is a straight-sided, high-shouldered bottle, and there for all the Bordeaux-style wines. Okay. Now, I expect you to use this information at the next party you go to.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Catherine on the line. So, Catherine, what profound subject do you want to explore today?
Hi, Lynn. We are entertaining casually, and I'm going to be serving a borscht-style casserole, maybe a beef burgundy, and other hearty comfort foods.
Right, right.
Is it possible to clean a pumpkin or other decorative squash or gourd and use it as a serving dish for such soups, casseroles, and stews?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So you're essentially you're doing soups and stews and that kind of thing, and you'd like to present them in a pumpkin in the spirit of the season.
Exactly. Or even I saw a beautiful decorative turban squash the other day that I thought, wow, wouldn't that be?
Oh, they're breathtaking, aren't they?
Yes.
What this comes down to is the best way to do this is to use the raw pumpkin or whatever the squash is. Because if you try to boil it or you try to bake it, it's going to fall apart. And it
sure
doesn't look good. The color's dull. There's a couple of things I do when I want to do something like this. A, I try to buy organic. The other thing is, what you do is you hollow it out, get rid of all of the seeds, whatever it may be.
Sure.
You take the top off in a way that you still have plenty of room inside.
Right.
And you hollow out and leave a shell about an inch thick. You want to make sure it's pretty sturdy.
Right.
All right. And then what I would do is I would pour boiling water. I just would put, if you have a big pumpkin, for instance, put it, upend it in the sink and pour boiling water over the outside and then flip it over and pour another kettle full of boiling water on the inside and drain it. That just, you know, it's just a little safety measure. And then you can put your hot stew or whatever it is into it and serve it. That's it.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate it.
Appreciate the great question.
Thank you.
Happy holidays.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have June calling. June, what do you want to talk about?
Hi.
Hello.
I want to talk about avocados.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
I was given a big box of them as a gift, and I'm hoping you can help me with some ideas. All I know how to make is guacamole.
Well, wait a minute. Are they all ripe?
Well, okay, here's the deal. They all ripened before I could give them away or figure out what to do with them. And I found out on the there's a website that
yeah.
you can freeze them. So now I have about 5 18-ounce packages of guacamole puree.
So you haven't seasoned them at all. You've just frozen the pureed.
Yes. I added the ascorbic acid so that it wouldn't go funny on me.
Right, right.
And I'm hoping you can help me with some suggestions.
Gosh, I've never had that much frozen avocado at my disposal. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. You know the first thing that comes to mind?
What's that?
I mean, obviously, you can defrost it and make guacamole.
Right.
Oh, have you ever had chili avocado ice cream?
No.
Oh, this is the food of the gods.
Oh, my gosh.
My pal in Denver, Sam Arnold, who is Mr. Chili, okay, Sam created this. Now, this is what you do. You go out and you buy pistachio ice cream.
Okay.
You take the ice cream, you soften it slightly, you take toasted pistachios, you take a ton of the avocado. So you want to do almost half and half of a pureed avocado and pistachio ice cream.
Okay.
You mince up a jalapeno chili, all right, with a little fresh lime juice. Because you want that accent of the lime. You fold that all together and you put it back in the freezer and you serve it just lightly melted.
Oh, that
it is because, and oh, add vanilla.
Oh,
I almost forgot.
Vanilla? Yeah. Like a teaspoon or so?
That's right. And now the other thing is, believe it or not, avocados love vanilla, they like sugar, and they adore whipped cream.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, then let's go to the savory side. You can do a pureed avocado soup. And this you do, again, by adding broth, and this could be a cold soup. Don't heat an avocado, by the way. It just loses it when you try to heat it.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. So you take chicken broth that you've completely defatted. You take some half and half. You take fresh tarragon and a little grated fresh ginger, all right, and black pepper and salt to taste. And you blend that, and then if you want, you can add some chopped chives or scallion tops and keep playing with it, you know, because this is the kind of thing that you mix it in just in a bowl.
Yeah.
You chill it, and then when you serve it with a dollop of your avocado puree right in the center of it.
I knew you would have heavenly suggestions.
Well, you know, I mean, you have such luxury in the freezer.
I think people
rave over caviar and whatever, and they don't, I mean, good avocado is really luscious stuff.
And these were really good.
Now, the other thing is, do you know how good it is for your skin?
Well, I saw something on the webpage about that.
Well, you can slather it all over your body, you know, roll around in the bathtub for a while and then rinse it off, and you're going to just be as slick as a seal. You are going to just be irresistible.
Maybe I should share said some to you, too.
You know, now that we're getting into this, this is not a bad idea.
This time of year, it sounds really good, doesn't it?
It sure does. Rub it on your body, drink it as soup, and make it into dessert. What could be bad? Is there anything more we could do? No.
Lynn, that's great.
Hey, you enjoy the avocados.
I will. Thanks for your help.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We'll take a shot at almost any question. We have Paige calling. Paige, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about my walk.
Yes.
My husband and I pledged to our public radio station, and we got a walk as our premium gift. And it's the kind of thing where you need to season it over time. And I'm having a really hard time building up a finish in it because stuff tends to burn on it and kind of crust and it gets all cakey and messy. And then, you know, we eat our dinner and then we go back to the kitchen and we're not supposed to use soap and water on this yucky, messy, burny wok. And I'm just kind of at a loss.
Well, Paige, I want to get back to the beginning. Which public radio station is giving away woks as a premium? This is very good stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's WQED 89.3 FM in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Now we know. Now we know. I mean, we give books and stuff, but a wok? This is really, this is big time.
Yep.
Well, how did you season it originally?
You know, I think I just started using it, and I used a lot of oil.
This is for everybody. We're talking not about something that has a coating on it like a Teflon wok. We're talking about the old-fashioned wok that is essentially a rolled steel or some kind of metal.
Yes.
Usually, and you have to build up, but usually this is the way you do it. The first time that you use it, you take a Brillo pad and you scrub the whole thing outside and in.
Okay.
You rinse it with hot water and you either put it, does it have a wooden handle on it?
Yes.
It does. Okay, then you'll put it over very, very low heat on top of the stove and let it dry completely.
Okay.
Once it's done that, rub the inside very liberally with a vegetable oil, not olive oil, something relatively flavorless.
Okay.
Put it back over that very, very, very low heat. And you leave it over the low heat for about a half hour. Let it cool completely, okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, from this moment on, you will never use soap. But you will rinse it out with hot water, wipe it dry, and you will repeat that oiling process two more times. So you do it a total of three times.
Okay.
Now you're going to start to use your wok. And in the beginning, you should be liberal with the oil. I don't mean excessively, but if a recipe calls for 3 tablespoons, I would maybe use 4.
Okay.
All right. And the way you clean the wok, remember you don't use any soap again.
Right.
But what you do is you scrub it out with salt.
Ah.
Well, the idea is the salt is an abrasive. It'll get rid of everything that's sticking, okay? So you won't have crusty stuff in the bottom of the pan. And you rinse it with very hot water, and you always dry it over extremely low heat. And then when it's totally cooled, you put it away. And every once in a while, give it a little coat of oil and put it over that heat. And what's going to happen is it will blacken. And over a period of time, the more you use it, the better it gets. And never let anyone touch a Brillo pad, soap, or anything like that to it.
Okay. And since I didn't call you promptly enough to start out on the right foot.
Go backwards.
Oh, so I should scrub it with Brillo, start as if I'd never done it.
Yeah, just start as though you never did it before.
Okay.
You know, and that's what you would do if somebody, I mean, I remember years ago, I used to teach Chinese cooking, and I got my wok, it looked like ebony. It was so magnificent. Mm. And an aunt of mine came to dinner, and we did this great Chinese feast for our guests, and she wanted to help. And when I walked in the kitchen, there was the silver medal in the interior of my wok.
Oh,
and she was
no.
so proud. She said, Lynn, I scrubbed this thing for 20 minutes, and look, I finally got the black gunk off. And, you know, there was 3 years. down the drain. But it's not a hard thing to do. I don't make it sound laborious. And once you learn how to take care of it, it's very quick to clean.
All right.
Hey, enjoy.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Goodbye, Paige.
Bye.
I got an email recently from a cheesemaker named Jonathan White. Now, he had the Egg Farm Dairy near New York City, but he wrote me about a project. I figured we all had to hear about this. We've got Jonathan White on the phone. Jonathan, thanks for talking with us.
No problem.
You better describe what you mentioned in your email.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, this is the sort of story that has to be true because I couldn't possibly have made it up. Well, as you know, I left Egg Farm Dairy about a year and a half ago. And my wife and I started an organization called Grasslands Cheese Consortium. And specifically what we're doing at the consortium is we're working with dairy farmers. We thought in this country, specifically farmers who graze their cows, we're working with them and helping them to become cheesemakers as a way of making grass-based dairy farming more economical.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I get a call from an organization in New York City, which is doing economic development work in on the Tibetan Plateau with nomadic yak herders. They were trying to create a source of income for these nomads, who are actually some of the poorest people in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmers, like dairy farmers everywhere, they have too much milk in the spring, they have virtually nothing in the winter, and they're very poor. And they actually have more milk in the spring than they can possibly use. So the idea is that if they can turn that milk into cheese and earn some outside income, they can greatly improve the quality of their lives. So that's what I did. This summer I spent 3 weeks up at 14,000 feet where there's half as much oxygen as there is here, living in a tent, working with the nomads, eating yak and noodle twice a day. And the yak themselves are grazing at 14,000 feet. They're basically semi-wild animals, and they're grazing on about 60 species of wildflower.
This milk must taste like, this must be delicious.
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is the milk of every cheesemaker's dreams. They get very little. A yak is about the size of a cow. It sort of looks like a cow with dreadlocks. They've got very long, scraggly sort of hair. Even though they're as big as a cow, they give about as much milk as a goat. You get about a liter, 2 liters a day.
But is cheese a part of their diet? Is there a tradition of cheese in that
area?
No,
it's not. The amazing thing is that it's not. Butter is a huge part of their diet. And what they normally do is they skim the fat, churn butter from it, which they use as food. They also use it to fuel the candles on their in front of their altars. They're very devoutly religious people. And I think during the winter, butter is something like half their calories. But during the summer, they actually have more milk than they can really use. So, you know, making cheese was the perfect economic thing for them because it's using up something that's going to waste otherwise. And the numbers work out kind of like this. For every 10-kilo wheel of cheese that we produce...
20 pounds.
22 pounds, yeah.
Yeah.
We take a family out of poverty for a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so the cheese is all made. They stop producing at the end of September when the milk is gone. And actually, I'm bringing the cheese into the U.S., you know, as a way of giving them, because there's not really a market for cheese in China. It's just not a product that people in that part of the world, either Tibet or China, are accustomed to. So, you know, the project has sort of taken me in a direction that I never would have dreamed of, but it's actually very much an identical project to what we're doing in this country. And, you know, it's amazing how similar the issues are from the Tibetan Plateau to the Midwest to the Northeast of the U.S. It's you know, if you're a dairy farmer these days, access to market for your product is the key. And here are folks that have the most incredible milk in the world, but they're one of the remotest human civilizations.
Well, Jonathan, we're going to look for yak cheese.
Uh-huh.
And thank you.
Okay.
Jonathan.
Nice speaking to you.
Good speaking to you. Thank you, Jonathan.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Jonathan White is a cheesemaker and creator of CowsOutside.com. Now, you can get information on the Tibetan yak cheese on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Charles de Gaulle. He said, "How can you expect to govern a country that has 246 kinds of cheese?" The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101, or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Cuban Agriculture piece was produced by Mary Stuckey. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.